This is Nature 11, and what we have been exploring in nature is the context in which our lives occur. And our lives are a context in which our personality occurs. So in the simplest kind of diagram, you could say that our person is held within the cup of life, and that the cup of life is held within the hand of nature. Now, this simple diagram, or this simple symbol, is very easy to understand. Note that there's no possibility of a person without life first, and there's no possibility of life without nature first. So that there is a sequence. There's an ABC. And so our education pays attention to this basic lesson, that there is a context which is realistic, and there is a sequence which is necessary. Now, with this simple coordinate, that there is a context and a sequence, we are able to have an education which is truthful and practical. Now, I have for you today a retrospective to show you how far we have come, though you may not have realized it, and how exacting our learning has been so far, and how prepared we are now to explore a completely new order. For ritual is a new order of nature. Ritual is an objective order, whereas nature has no objective qualities other than an impermanent, discontinuous approximation. And in order to balance the discontinuous approximation of nature, ritual has an emphasis on the continuous and on the definite. And so ritual will be characterized by a need for exactness, a need for repetitive exactness, so as to put a hand onto the flow of nature and give us, through a cross-section of the process, through, as we would say in photography, a snapshot of the situation, ritual tries to fix for us some kind of determination, a kind of a calipers, an objective body which is able to literally embody nature as life. So that ritual will always be, wherever it occurs, whether it's the housewife trying to clean with the Lysol and all the other products to maintain a clean house, or whether it's the ancient persons of Central Asia doing the Aswamedha horse sacrifice to purify the king so that the kingdom will be purified and safe and clean, that the enormous spread of ritual has a singular quality of purpose, that is to give forms to life which will be safe which will be dependable, which will be clean, which will work, so that life will have a body to inhabit. Before we get to ritual, we have two more sections on nature. We have Nature 11 today, and we have Nature 12 next week. And I want to present today to you a sequence, a series, to illuminate how far we have come, and also to have this series remind us of how close nature is to a cosmic vision. But that this cosmic vision is extremely difficult to come by, and that ritual alone is not enough. In fact, ritual is only a beginning, a sketch towards what the cosmos is in its actuality. And we will see in our education that the cosmos has a particular kind of objective quality. Its objectiveness depends upon the person, and that the person is a very mysterious, scintillating prism, rather than being some static kind of object, is like an iridescent prism, and its objectiveness, being completely mysterious, is based upon an objectivity of the mind, and that the mind, characterized for many thousands of years as so quick and facile as to be like quicksilver among the elements. And so the difficulty of the objective cosmos is there because of the difficulty of the iridescent person, which is there because of the mysteriousness of the mind, which is held by the only objective place where clarity can be insisted upon, and that is in the ritual body. But the ritual body itself is but a frame of nature. And so in the entire ecology of our education, in the entire spectrum of reality, the only place in which certainty founds itself, clutches, clings, determines, is in existence. And so existence will be characterized by this quality of grasping, of holding, of being tenacious, of not letting go. Though what it grasps and what it does not let go of is purely nature. And so we're faced with a great difficulty. The difficulty is that the only certainty we have is by what we can grasp. It's like the hand, which in its grasping is quite definite, but what the hand is able to grasp is indefinite and can only be made definite by focusing upon the grasping itself, so that existence becomes objective by living it. And when we try to penetrate what is it that we are living, why are we living, for what purpose are we living, all of this becomes more and more indefinite the more we try to translate our attention from the grasp to what it is that we have grasped or are attempting to grasp. And so education in its primordial quality is always a mystery unfoldment. But that the unfoldment has a process characterization characteristically of the unfoldment, as we will see in about a half an hour's time, is not an unfoldment like a plane which has been folded and then you simply mechanically unfold and end up with the plane. The unfoldment is an ongoing process, so that the unfoldment takes the form of a rotation around the axis of directional energy. And the rotation has specific angles of rotational turn and specific measurable distances of furthering, so that when you look at this unfoldment in a multidimensional whole, you get a helical quality. So that unfoldment, rather than being an unfoldment of a plane, is an unfoldment of a rotational, directional sequencing, which becomes a helix. And in fact, because of the nature of polarity, it is a double helix. And so the very structure of life, being based on the double helix, is not remarkable at all from a wisdom standpoint, but extremely remarkable from the natural standpoint. And as we will see towards the end of the first part of the lecture, it became apparent to natural genius that the structure of life had to be a helix. In fact, it was called, because of its primordiality, the alpha helix. Linus Pauling at Caltech gave it the designation, which became famous around the world, of the alpha helix. And the alpha helix structure was thought to be very close, if not exactly, the structure of life. And it took two wild card jokers, two young men in England, who through a complete ignoring of nature, a kind of a hermetic stealing of thunder, that they were able to come up with the double helix. Now, the very first beginning of this sequence, and I'm going to show us a sequence of books which all have to do with mathematics. But we're not going to be studying mathematics. This sequence is unfolded, not like a plane, but like a helix. And the unfolding is simply to take objects, which are mathematical books, and to bring them into a natural helical development, which summarizes and characterizes what we have done here for 10 weeks. Now, the very first one is a classic by a man named Dedekind, Essays on the Theory of Numbers. And it originally came out in 1901. And the logical foundation of numbers was something that Dedekind and his book produced. That is to say that mathematics and logic work in a similar way. And it was a little later than Dedekind that Alfred North Whitehead and Bertrand Russell were able, in a big three-volume set called Principia Mathematica, were able to redo the thought of the original Principia written by Sir Isaac Newton in 1687. And in Principia Mathematica, it was shown that the similarity between mathematics and logic was so close as to be, as one would say in geometry, congruent. that the shapes of their development held over each other showed the same shape. This similarity to the point of congruence is different from identity. And to misunderstand identity as the congruence of similarity, as there being a possibility of a convergence to a congruence, is a primordial error and fault in the development of the mind. The 20th century has been a complete century of development of the implications of this particular realization, of this particular truth. Whatever characterizes the greatness of the 20th century, it is example after example and field after field that the insistence on identity is a medieval misnomer, and that the reliance upon probability and possibility, which includes in its range a convergence of similarity to the point of congruency, is a much more realistic outlook. That nature is characterizable by this. Nature is a matrix of change containing possibilities without end, and that one of those possibilities is convergence to the point of congruence. And so there is exactness that occurs in nature, but the exactness occurs only where it does occur and not anywhere else. If you have a gas of a certain element, and you have a light source that comes in, the spectrograph will be excited. There will be an excitation line on the spectrograph exactly where the light hits the atoms of that particular gas. Along with the excitation line of that particular gas, those molecules being struck by light, there will be other lines symmetrically around the excitation line. They're called Raman spectrum lines, named for C.V. Raman, the Indian mathematician who described them mathematically best in the 1920s. Those auxiliary excitations are only visible on the higher frequency side of the symmetricality and not on the lower frequency side. Though they occur at a weaker energy so as to not be visible. And in a way, the peculiarity of Raman spectroscopy is that the invisible and the visible are always a symmetricality in nature. But their symmetricality is arranged around an exactness. And so nature is truly an astonishing magic. The exactness that does occur and will occur is a possibility, not an identity. And so that the wise development of the appreciation of ourselves and each other and life can be firmly founded on possibility rather than on absolute. And this is a certainty. The equivalence of certainty with absolutes is characterization of a medieval mindset and is completely irrational, completely nonsensical, is incapable of learning from nature, and incapable of understanding logic of any sort whatsoever. So we're beginning with essays on the theory of numbers, because the designation of a numeracy, numerical designation, precedes literacy. Numeracy comes before literacy. Before human beings learned to write, they learned to count. And before there were words that were written expressible, there were numbers that were written that were expressible. And so very early on, the earliest forms of written language are actually like account books of numbers. And the mystery of numbers is at the very core of written language. The most mysterious number of all is the number one. And one is mysterious because it occurs. That there should be one, that there is one, that one can designate one, that the one who designates one is a one. This is a mystery. And the mystery takes form, it becomes graspable when we realize that one occurs against zero. And so the next book is Polar Rearrangement. It has to do with chemistry. It's just an Oxford chemistry primer founded by a consortium of chemical companies, so that the cost is very minimal. Polar rearrangements. That is to say that nature is characterized by a matrix of change, the movement of which is rearrangements of polarities that are founded on zero and one. On one as a form against the context of zero, or zero as a form against the context of oneness, which is much more harder to see. That one occurs against zero was seen clearly 5,000 years ago. To see zero clearly against one occurred only about 1800, 1900 years ago. Much more recent, much more difficult to see. In fact, it occurred in such historical times that we know that the very first person to be able to understand zero as a form against the context of one was named Nagarjuna. He lived in India. And he lived well over 100 years. And the old sage Nagarjuna, Naga means snake in Sanskrit. So he was the snake sage of the world at that time, a younger contemporary of Plotinus in the West. One can be seen against the context of zero. Zero can be a form which is seeable only in a mysterious scintillating gestalt. While we can picture one by holding up a finger, the best picture of zero is to hold up a hand with no fingers raised whatsoever. Now, we make a zero like this, and the reason for this is that the mudra that was used by Nagarjuna in ancient India to first bring out zero quality, the statement that zero exists as a form was confirmed by a mudra of exactness. And this mudra travels throughout the world for 1900 years, and still means in the United States, when I was a boy, that everything is okay. Everything is exactly right. It's an ancient mudra from India that was the confirmation that zero is in fact discernible as a form against the context of one. One of the natural lessons of wisdom that is learnable from this is that nature in its processes are reversible. the phases of nature are reversible, and also that the phases of nature are transformable. That transformation and reversibility go along with the ongoingness, so that nature evolves, but it can also devolve, and it can also transform. So that nature has this multiplicity of its capacity, and that because of symmetry, because of the similarity in symmetry, one possibility of which is the exactness of congruence, but all the other possibilities are only approaching that congruence, so that most of nature, most of the universe, is characterized by possibilities of approach to congruence rather than congruence itself. And that zero and one are exactnesses of congruence, and all the other infinite steps in between, all of the infinite quantities between zero and one, or between one and zero, are possibilities without end. That one can divide the measure between zero and one into an infinite series of possibilities. Now, the realization of this, the development of this ability to calculate what exactly at this particular probability or possibility, how far have we come from zero approaching one, or how far have we come from one approaching zero? This kind of calculation was first made in a written form in this world only about 300 years ago. And so the characterization of nature as exact possibilities vis-a-vis a measurement between zero and one, or one and zero, is the whole nature of the mathematics of calculus. It's called calculus because one is calculating. One is calculating the approach possibilities to limits, the limits being zero and one. And Sir Isaac Newton and a man named Leibniz in Europe were the first to develop the notation for this about 300 years ago. We use today the notation of Leibniz because Leibniz's notation is less tainted by a medievalism than that of Newton. Newton stretched on his tiptoes in order to express calculus, whereas Leibniz was doing it sitting down. He had a much more firm foundation. Part of the reason is that Newton was doing it as a semi-feral genius, and Leibniz was doing it as someone who had been tutored and educated by some of the best minds available in his time, minds like those of Spinoza. Whereas Newton spent most of his life as a loner. Even when he was master of the mint in England, he was almost not approachable because of his gigantic pedestal crowning genius and his dislike of other people and his suspicion of life and the world. Leibniz was the royal tutor and the head librarian for the family that eventually moved from Germany to England and founded the House of Hanover, founded through George I, the current line of English kings. So Leibniz was the personal tutor to the family that became the House of Hanover as the kings and queens of England. So he was immensely in the very swim of history. Essays on the Theory of Numbers. Not only is one a form against zero, but two is a form against the context of zero and one, and three against the context of zero, one, and two. And so each development of number begins to have a what we would call an orthogonal, a kind of a shape and a form that comes out until we reach, in the Arabic script, the number 9. Now, it doesn't occur in other scripts. In the earliest designation of numeracy, one would make a line, another line, a fourth line, a fifth line. But if you keep on making lines like that, eventually it becomes difficult to see. We today have children that will make four lines and then they'll put a cross line and that'll be 5. V was the Latin form for 5. And so 4, instead of being written 4 lines, was written 1 line before the V, and then 5, and then 1 line after the V, and 2, and 3. And so in the Latin script, there was never more than 3 lines at any one time. And when you got to 10, 10 was an X. So 9 was written IV, 1X, like IV for 4, IX for 9. But in the Arabic script, which went back into a deeper origin than the Latin mind based itself upon the Greek, but in such a way that it ritually selected only what it wanted to use from the Greek, and lost in the selection, in the translation, some of the archaic wisdom that was there in Greek. Whereas the Arabic civilization is older than Islam. Islam, incidentally, is a reformation of Judaism. Muslims are Protestant Jews in a very real historical way. But the Arabic number system goes back to the old archaic Iranian. And in that system, one has a single digit up to 9. And when 1 comes to 10, 1 comes back to 1 and 0 again. And so that the base shifts and the levels of order shift because Arabic is based on a base of 10, which is the two hands that are brought together. And so when 1 writes 10, 1 and 0, it's like the two hands of prayer. And so the whole base of number development is based upon the comprehension of the symmetrical similarity that is able to converge, and that when it's spread out into its fundamental binary base, when one goes to a higher order, you have to restate the base. And so while the base of the first order of numbers based on 10, 0 is invisible, on every order after that, 0 must be made expressible. And so the invisibility of 0 is transformed into a visibility. And thus, 1 writes 10 as 1 and 0. On the first level, 0 is invisible because the context is assumable. But on the second order, when one begins with 10, one has to make 0 visible. And this time, the visible 0 works all the way up to 99. And then one comes to a third level, 100, where one has to write 0 and repeat it. And at every power of 10, one has to repeat another visible zero. And so that the nature, the theory, the theoretical quality of numbers is that nature occurs in powers, and that each order of power of nature requires of an expressive ritual designation that it restate and keep doubling or tripling or quadrupling, that however high one goes on the orders of nature, one has to bring the fundamental quality of the primordial context, that of zero and number, back into restatement that many times. So that there is an inverse pyramid of the order of nature. And as one goes up the levels of natural spread, the designation of those is a repeat of the essential context which was there at the beginning. So that nature has a polar rearrangement as a quality, both on the chemical level, on the logical level, on the artistic level, on the psychological level, that order of polar rearrangement expansion yields a periodicity. This book, the periodicity and the P-block elements, the P-block and S-block elements, it's a whole series of elements, including oxygen and carbon, which have a quality that all the different blocks of elements have, that is periodicity. Just as one reoccurs on a higher level as one and zero, and reoccurs on a higher level of one and zero and zero, and one and zero and zero and zero, there's a periodicity that the orders of nature are not haphazard, but are exact, and their exactness is a periodicity. And the periodicity has to do with the way in which existence actually occurs. And existence actually occurs like a sine wave of energy. And as that sine wave of energy extends its amplification, its frequency gets more energy. Nature gets energized to wake up more. The sine wave repeats in a periodicity which increases in this kind of reverse pyramid opening up. It becomes 10, 10 times 10, 10 times that, so that the periodicity is by the base. So that when one knows what is the base that one is working with in terms of powers, in terms of orders, the periodicity will be measurable exactly in terms of that base. Now, our Arabic number system uses a base of 10. You can use a base of 2. You can use a base of any number that you wish. You can even in logic use an N base. Nature yields its existence in exactness in terms of a periodicity which is determinable by its orders of increment, so that there is such a thing as a periodic table of the elements, and that this table of the elements is able to be visualized and manipulated as a matrix, so that there is such a thing as a theory of matrices, that nature can be seen as a matrix, and within that matrix, when one knows the periodicity based on the polar rearrangements, then vectors, developments can be seen and tracked exactly. How exact? To any degree of specificity. And that once one can track vectors, as soon as you track two or more vectors, you then have a tensor. And a tensor is a form of nature, which determines a set of possibilities. And there is such a thing as a theory of sets. This theory of sets shows that within nature, always, there are phase equilibria, that each set tries to establish a distribution, an equilibrium of energy throughout the entire shape and form of the set. And then at a higher order, between sets, all of the sets that occur together as a larger set will try to redistribute the energy available according to that larger gestalt, and so on. So that nature is able to be characterized not only as a series, as a sequence which has a periodicity, but there are also forms, orthogonal forms they're called in mathematics, or orthogonal functions. This is Fourier series. Fourier was a genius around the time of the French Revolution, who developed for the first time a mathematics of keeping track of all of the difficult approximations that were quite exact of the development along the kinds of vectors that came out in calculus, the finer qualities. In fact, Fourier's achievement was so great that he was given almost anything by the French people, and he was enshrined as the genius of the age. He was the French Newton. He was the French Leibniz. And today, Fourier analysis is one of the foundations of integration. So that one has here an introduction to the theory of Fourier series and integrals. So that the whole development of integration can be characterized by example of a sequence periodicity that's calculable to any point of exactness given the possibility matrix, and this is how integration always works. That is to say, it works this way even when the beginning is followed by a random series, so that one has, like random walks in biology. There's a whole mathematics of random walks. Now, you began your education by taking a random walk. You followed it up the next week by taking another walk with the randomness reduced by one element, by keeping track of fire or water or some other single element. Then you followed it by a third walk in which you kept track of two elements. Now, if you did that exercise, if the first week you just took a random walk, and the second week you took a random walk with only the introduction of one element of determinable stability, and then followed it the third week with a random walk of two elements of determinable stability, you have intuitively now the basis of all the developments of higher mathematics in the 20th century. You have every possibility now of understanding nature on level of 21st century, just by that. Now, the shapes that are made, because they are shapes of an energy ordering sequencing, which gives definite shape and form and exactness as a function of that energy, there is the possibility of introducing, just like introducing light into a body of gas and having an excitation line on the spectrograph of elements exactly at that element, one can introduce into the universe an energy like light, or a higher energy of light like an X-ray. And when one introduces an X-ray into the molecular structures of existence, one comes up with an exactness which characterizes what is really there in terms of graspable, measurable possibility that has come to be. And we will see that the whole development of the double helix was all based upon the fact that X-ray crystallography by the early 1950s, after 40 years, had come a long way into being a recognizable language. And that the great genius of about 1950 was Linus Pauling here at Caltech, who had understood that of all the molecules that exist in life, the one most interesting to him was the hemoglobin molecule, and that when a hemoglobin quantity is introduced into an acid solution and heated, the acid solution will crystallize out, and the crystal structure will be of those molecules. And so the hemoglobin molecules will make a crystal of hemoglobin. And when you introduce an X-ray light source into that crystal form of hemoglobin, it will disclose in an X-ray spectrograph the very structure that is there that would have been invisible otherwise. Because one has brought the hidden zero out at higher powers of resolution. And while the zero is hidden there in nature, it is disclosable on higher powers of resolution. And that human beings are spirits that are capable of such high power of resolution energy as to be able to see the zero to any degree of necessity, even zeroness itself, and that we've had this capacity for at least 2,000 years. Let's take a break. Notice that it's very difficult to concentrate on a form which is scintillating, which is moving, and not only moving, but circulating, and not only moving and circulating, but iridescently is bringing zero into play a trillion times a second. This is the quality of thought. And so when someone like myself presents a pristine, naked thought process, it has a quality that is so dazzling in its structure as to not be seeable. And yet, men and women have, in their spiritual dimension, the vastness of character and the elegance of consciousness to be able to grasp a single thought, a single moment of thought. In India, a single moment of thought is called a bodhicitta. And in ancient times, when there were no wide range of distractions like we have today, and men and women had to be, because of necessity, exacting about what they were doing, the meditation on a moment of thought produced a snapshot of a bodhicitta, a diagram of a moment of thought. And it was found time and time again that a moment of thought has 16 parts. No more, no less. 16. But that only the first 8 parts occur in any kind of distinct individual fashion. And the second 8 always occur together as a trill. that when you resolve yogic concentration to the point of being able to discern, and now you can see that discernment means something much more refined than just simply getting it. One can get it to subatomic level, folks. That no matter how refined one got, the second eight always occurred together like a musical trill. That they went together as a chord, and that chord was what the nature of zero was. And that only by playing the chord again and again, though it did not occur distinctly, it always occurred with that kind of trill. And that was the movement of the distinct other eight together. So that thought has a dynamic. Thought has a movement like a ballet. In the 60s, when the phrase was follow the ballet of thought, became such a cliche that by the late 1960s, tourists were using it. Very few took a front row seat long enough to learn that this was quite extraordinarily nuclear physics of the mind. So the 16-spoked wheel was the symbol for ancient Indian civilization. When the flag of independent India was first made available, the very first flag of India was the charka, was the spinning wheel of Gandhi. And then anti-Gandhi forces said, well, we want to have something more universal than Gandhi. So they used the 16-spoke wheel in the center of the Indian flag. This quality of looking at a split second of thought, an atom of thought, and seeing that there is this polarity, that nature occurs both in specific exactness and in chord trilling gestalts that are never more exact than just that, gives its character to thought, so that thought always has an iridescent glint when it works. Intuition always has a light on the spherical surface of the structure, because that's the way nature is. In some moments of deep reverie, when you see a body of water from a certain angle in a certain light, and you see the thousands of sparkles and the ripple of the ocean, or the lake, or the stream, or the dewdrops on the leaves in the early morning. This is the image of the thought of the universe made manifest. On that level, on the level of the elegant, exact poetry of nature, this kind of disclosure is characteristic rather than the exception. It's simply the way in which it needs to be done to be of service. And so while it may seem rare at the end of the 20th century in terms of civilization, it's simply the way an education that Israel works. That's all. Newton's optics is the second part of our little stack of books here. The sequence of these books is a sequence showing that when nature is looked at in terms of itself. We cannot ask the question, what is it? We need to rather ask a process question, what is happening? What is going on? If we ask, what is it? It's a question that predisposes us to an assumption that there is an identity to be discovered, to be tacked down, and nature disappoints that expectation all the time, every time. Someone once characterized nature as the spirit of romance, that as soon as you seek to look beneath the veil, she is gone. She will dance elsewhere, not here, not for you. That she requires respect for the spirit of romance. And so as not to be a butcher of the real, but an appreciator of the dance. Instead of trying to grab and grasp nature in that way, wise men and women have learned that if they open their hands and cup them in a certain receptive way, that they can intuit what is going on. And that the grasping of it is the grasping by filling in the form that you can make with the trill that you cannot make. And so the earliest forms of sacredness were to create forms that were open specifically to receive the rest of the mystery of nature. So when the North American Plains Indians would arrange their teepees on great ceremonial occasions, say like the Okan, the sun dance, there would always be one space left open. No teepee is there. Why? Because this is the egress of the spirit. The great spirit comes in. The great spirit pitches her teepee there. It is not of our making, but of hers. So when the Zen Sumiye artist draws his circle, he does not close the circle. The great lesson in Sumiye was to have your paper. Yes, we have to move, right? The paper stretched taut like a drum. Here on your table are the jars of the ink, and a big jar of brushes. And you prepare yourself in one movement to take a brush and dip. And if you pause, you will tear the paper. If you complete the circle, the pressure will tear the paper. You cannot pause and you cannot complete. Because the movement of Zen, meaning Chan, meaning meditation, meaning mind, meaning energy of universe, meaning nature, that the movement does not complete itself as an identity. It never happens. So why do human beings talk about identity? Because they fantasize and project a completion of nature and think that nature is completed with their contribution of their projection. That's what's illusion. Identity is the archetypal illusion. The completion is never there. That you assume that it's there because that's how you see it, is simply the thermometer showing fever. And the illusion is there, and the projection and the perception of incorporating the projection into nature, assuming that what you add, that your spit in the wind then makes a moisture of nature. This, when one believes in that and acts upon that basis, is no longer simply illusion, but is delusion. And the ocean of delusion is deeper than the atmosphere, deeper than the stratosphere. It's all-encompassing. It's like a bubble, but is vulnerable like a bubble, because once penetrated anywhere, the delusion loses confidence, and the illusion becomes able to be blinkable, so that there are moments when you see that it's simply not so. And the development of an education, a wisdom, is not only to dissuade you from the delusion and wake you from the illusion, but to encourage you to accept the incompleteness as a more exact possibility of the real, rather than the expectation that things must be this way because that's how they are said, that's how they are taught. No, they are not that way. Those that say are ignorant, those that teach that way are stupid. And it's no function of majority, because the majority are in delusion. So when there's an opportunity to burst that bubble, do not be deterred by the uncertainty that comes. The first sign of losing illusion is to experience disillusionment. It's a natural part of learning, a natural part of wisdom coming out. That kind of uncertainty is interpreted by the ego as a queasiness which is to be avoided, because what are we going to do? Our bank accounts, our jobs, our fictions are all based on the delusion. And they're all going to have to go. We're going to have to redo everything. Yes, but there's plenty of time. And once educated, life really is there. Now, we talked earlier before the break about how the structure of existence on level of organic life is revealed in crystals of the molecules that are the very structure, like the crystals of hemoglobin that Linus Pauling was using, among others, at Caltech, right here in town, about a half century ago. And understanding that if you introduce a light source which is higher than visible light, X-ray, that this X-ray crystallography will produce snapshots of structure which are extremely refined, more refined than those that you could see no matter how powerful the microscope is. The microscope only works with visible light. X-rays, higher frequency, shows more detailed structure, shows invisible structure. At this point, if you have any delusion based on any illusion, you will not only not be able to see, but the method itself will be questionable and you won't use it. You won't do it. So there's a double awakening. There's an awakening from the delusion of the ordinary, and there's an awakening from the illusion of the misconception. Perception and conception both have to be awakened. And part of the development of wisdom is to awaken the perception of nature first. Pie in the sky, weekend yogas try to awaken your conception. And you can do this forever and never come into possession of freedom, because the illusion base, the perceptual base of illusion, can generate false concepts indefinitely. Perception has to do with the ritual level of comportment towards nature, so that the very first traction that we have in education is to be able to participate in nature as nature. To participate in nature completely and fully. Now, there was a Frenchman named Lucien Levi-Brule who called this mystical participation, and was an anthropologist and a philosopher of the earliest man. And Levi-Brule said that the earliest development of our species was to participate in nature, to be able to return back to nature on level of participating in it without any additions whatsoever, not completing any circles, not finishing any triangles, not making any kind of geometrical forms that are not there. To refrain from retouching nature, to refrain from interfering with nature, to simply participate with what is going on. And we will see in ritual that the most refined of all rituals is mindfulness. Satipatthana. And that man, 40,000 years ago, already had the ability to participate with nature, as Lucien Levi-Brule used, the participation on that level is a mystique. There's a mystique to that participation. And when you have yourself immersed in the mystique of the participation of nature, all the rest of nature resonates with you. To put it in another way, you resonate within. That is to say, the form that you are stands out against the context of nature, and reversible, nature stands out against the context of you. It goes either way, it goes both ways in exact similarity, in symmetrical reversibility, and that symmetrical reversibility is the basis of all transformations. All forms, on whatever level of order and transformation is jumping orders, forms jumping orders, that all transformations are based upon the primordial exchangeability of zero and one, of context and form, of one standing out against zero, or zero standing out against oneness, of you occurring in nature, of nature occurring in you. And the surprise, the supreme surprise, is that our reality is such that nature as a whole can occur. There is a possibility, only one. Nevertheless, there is one possibility where nature occurs as a whole against the context that we are. That our reality is ultimately so vast that all of nature occurs as a form against us. That we are not some petty animal, but an eternal spirit so vast that even the time forms of the proton occur as forms against us. And on that level of nobility, men and women recover a decency that is able to bring them back out of any delusion, out of any illusion. The first step of being participation with nature in its own mystique, nature qua nature. The great example of this ability of light or of X-rays to show the hidden structure has to do with the way in which forms have a geometricity. And the geometricity always is the structure of imagination. That the image base of experience, its process is imagination. And that the structure of imagination is fundamentally geometrical. So that one of the greatest of all mathematicians, a man named David Hilbert, wrote a classic book that's still in print 100 years later called Geometry and the Imagination. This is the Hilbert for which Hilbert space is named in astrophysics. Geometry and the Imagination. In the very preface that we read, written in Göttingen, June 1932 by David Hilbert, in mathematics, as in any scientific research, we find two tendencies present. On the one hand, the tendency towards abstraction seeks to crystallize the logical relations inherent in the maze of material that is being studied. Crystallization again. On the other hand, the tendency towards intuitive understanding the light introduced into the crystalline structure to show the structure. On the other hand, the tendency towards intuitive understanding fosters a more immediate grasp of the objects one studies, a live rapport with them, a participation mystique, so to speak, which stresses the concrete meaning of their relations. Abstraction and intuition. Geometry and the imagination, X-rays and crystals, optics and structure. The polarity of reality, which is reversible, and because it's reversible, the actuality is not the polarity, but the complementation. That the true nature is not the special case of polarity, which is where the distinctness always is, but there is a complement, the invisible, indistinct trill, where the polarity is now reversed. When one stands out against zero, you have definiteness. But where zero stands out against oneness, there's an infinite indefiniteness, as there should be. And it's the height of egotistical illusion to assume that zero would have a shape like any other number, that it wouldn't be infinitely indefinite. And so one has to learn that the great complementation that an education must build in at every phase, at every step, is to incorporate the mystery of openness as an actual ingredient in whatever forms are being made at that moment. And that there is, in special cases of extreme congruence and integration, the case where the form is openness itself and not anything else. And that at the epitome of integration is a vanishing point at the center, which is openness itself, beyond which is no further integration, beyond which is the complement differentiation. And that the spiritual person is a differential form on the other side of integration, and is characterized not by a thing, but by the kind of transcendent thing that a prism would be, diffracting light into a spectrum. And that a healthy person is someone who is not an identity, but is capable of disclosing the whole spectrum of what is going on. Such a rainbow person was always held to be a spiritual being. So that along with x-rays and optics, random walks, integrals, Fourier series, phase equilibrium, theory of sets, tensor analysis, vectors, matrices, periodicity, polar arrangements, and way at the bottom, just numbers themselves. Little book by a woman, Elizabeth Wood, Crystals and Light, reprinted in Dover paperbacks, because it's just as good as it ever was done. That it's an introduction to optical crystallography, that crystals and light together are a place in existence, are a place in definite natural embodiment where abstraction and intuition come together and play. And when they play together, one finds that molecules vibrate. That molecules never just are stupidly, statically there, identity dead things, but they always vibrate. And that different molecules have different rates of vibration. And that the interplay of complex molecules with each other is the interplay of vibratory harmonics, so that on level of organic chemistry, when one has being that has several hundred thousand chemicals all at the same time as part of single gestalt, the harmony of a man or woman in nature is startlingly complex. There is no computer system going to be built in the next millennium capable of cataloging and resolving altogether that enormous gestalt. Nevertheless, molecules also have a sexual bifurcation. Not so much bifurcation, but interpenetration, complementation, and that such a thing as molecular crystals then, in terms of our life form, have a woven interplay. And that understanding this particular fabric, by 21st century, one can participate in designing the molecular world. that long before we can characterize the complex harmonies of several hundred thousand chemical vibrations all together, and what would that vibration tensor be? One learns to design here, basically chemistry at the frontier, inorganic molecules. All of this is available because of the realm of that disclosed by the double helix. Without the disclosure of the structure, the double helical structure of DNA, which was the key, it was like the keystone. It was like in the arch, just to digress for a moment, even in something as medievally based as Masonic ritual sequences, the operative keystone in the Masonic rituals is the Royal Arch ceremonies that hold all of the higher ceremonies, the other side of the arch, together with the original. And without the Royal Arch ceremonies, without that keystone, one could never have the entire spectrum. But on deeper, more profound level, more ancient and more futuristic, more penetrating even at the present, the structure of the double helix as a pristine keystone insight into the way in which nature occurs on order of us, on our level, took the film, took the veil, took the disillusion, took the illusion on such a primordial level as to wash the windows of the soul really well, not just on level of rare yogic mystic, but on level of tens of millions of men and women worldwide, able to now look with complete openness at nature on such fundamental level. One of the sweetest little volumes in this is Linus Pauling's The Architecture of Molecules. And when one looks at the architecture of molecules, by the time you get to section 39, and the sections are just pages, one comes to the hydrogen bond. And we are surprised to learn that as recent as 1920, it was discovered that hydrogen, the most primordial of all the atoms, the most basic element, the oneness of the material world, is the very glue that holds together atoms in molecular structures, especially in organic molecules, allowing for forms that we would recognize as constituents of us. Pauling writes, "The most important hydrogen bonds are those in which a hydrogen atom joins pairs of fluorine, oxygen, or nitrogen atoms together." And that this hydrogen bond allows for, in organic chemistry, for certain groups of atomic elements, a group of a carbon atom and two oxygen atoms and another hydrogen atom called the COOH set. Remember, we're talking about theories of sets. The COOH set occurs in all organic molecules. It's a constituent part. And one of the peculiarities with the hydrogen bond is that organic molecules can occur in doubles. that instead of there just being a molecule, that they can be linked together almost like mirror images of each other joined by common hydrogen atoms, and that the very first molecular medium that was discernible is the ancient liquid known as vinegar, acetic acid. Now, one of the classic Zen liquids back in China, before Zen was Japanese, it was Chan in China. And one of the most basic of all the Chan insight symbols was that of wise men together tasting vinegar. That vinegar had some kind of relationship with wine. That spirit water, distilled water made into alcohol, and alcohol had the capacity to not only be a wine, but also to be a vinegar. And so that vinegar and wine were both spiritual, but they were like spiritual polarities. They were the obverse of each other. They were the other side of each other. If you let a wine sit for a long time, it would become vinegar. And there's some way to revivify, redistill vinegar back into a wine. Acetic acid is the first double molecule. And here, Pauling writes, the explanation finally was provided by the theory of the hydrogen bond. According to this theory, two acetic acid molecules with the generally accepted structural formula could combine by forming two hydrogen bonds with one another to produce a double molecule, as shown in the adjacent drawing. When organic molecules can double like that, there's a quality then to molecular structure that begins to become apparent, that there are, in crystalline forms of matter, structural forms that are universal, and the most universal crystal of all in the whole universe is ice. And the molecular structure of ice shows that it has a hexagonal form, just like the I Ching's hexagrams, just like snowflakes. Now, of course, snowflakes would be hexagonal because they're ice crystal. And that the hexagonal crystallization of water characterizes a whole echelon throughout the universe, characterizes nature in such a way that water is not an exception in nature, but is one of the fundamentals. We know now from 1996 astrophysics from the Hubble telescope that there are great nebula stretching out in vast portions of our galaxy, and great nebula in other galaxies, and a great constituent of this interstellar gas is water vapor. That it's not some rare thing on an egotistically limited planet of some special illusion, but that water occurs throughout the universe characteristically. Ice occurs in denser forms than on the ice that you have in your refrigerator also. These molecules, these organic molecules that have the COOH, have the ability to form amino acids, and glycine is the simplest of all amino acids. We'll come back to this next week with amino acids. But the ability of amino acid molecules to come together, to link together with other amino acid molecules, to form chains, to form belts, to form threads. And one of the most characteristic of all the threads is silk and the molecular structure of silk, whether it's of spider's silk or silkworm silk, shows that molecular structure arranges itself into long threads. And one of the qualities of these threads is that polypeptide chains, as they're called, these threads are called, fold. They do not fold in a simplistic way, but they fold in a specific ongoing rotation around the axis of organization. Whether there's something there at the axis of rotation or not, usually there is nothing. Usually it's zero. There's only the invisible momentum of the ongoingness. And the atoms arrange themselves in a phase form rotation around this vectored axis. And so while there will be nothing there at the axis core, all of the atoms will arrange themselves, all of the molecules will arrange themselves around this vector core. And one gets this polypeptide chain. And this is the way molecular architecture actually happens. Thus, Pauling writes, the alpha helix characterizes the structure of polypeptide chains in organic chemistry. 35 angstroms long, the length of the alpha helix is 1.49 angstrom per amino acid residue. One can have any degree of exactness, not because one is searching for identity, but because one is open to actuality. Let's come back and let's expand at the same time. This education is a rotation in exactness around an ongoing core, which you must provide. And in order to help you keep track of the periodicity of the ongoingness is why we have the year-long journeys, the reading texts. Without integrating the year-long reading texts into each Saturday, you are missing one of the key exactnesses and measurements. I guess Melville's recommending himself. Homer bowed over. What is today, this week's reading in Melville? Where are we in Melville's journey? The masthead, which we already had a glimpse of and read an excerpt. It was during the more pleasant weather that in due rotation with the other seamen, my first masthead came round. Notice the synthesizing thread of the masthead in the rotation throughout the crew. In most American whalemen, the mastheads are manned almost simultaneously with the vessels leaving her port, even though she may have 15,000 miles or more to sail ere reaching her proper cruising ground. And if after a 3, 4, or 5 years voyage she is drawing nigh home with anything empty in her, say an empty vial even, then her mastheads are kept manned to the last, not till her sky poles sail in among the spires of the port, not until the congruence of the ship with the land again, does she altogether relinquish the hope of capturing one whale more? And how does the masthead end? And we'll end today with Melville's caution against those who unnaturally are not participating in the nature of the ocean and the sky from the masthead. Very often do the captains of such ships take those absent-minded young philosophers to task, upbraiding them with not feeling sufficient interest in the voyage, half hinting that they are so hopelessly lost to all honorable ambition is that in their secret souls they would rather not see whales than otherwise. But all in vain, those young Platonists have a notion that their vision is imperfect. They are short-sighted. What use then to strain the visual nerve? They have left their opera glasses at home. "Why, thou monkey," said a harpooner to one of these lads, "we've been cruising now hard on 3 years, and thou hast not raised a whale yet. Whales are scarce as hen teeth whenever thou art up there." Perhaps they were, or perhaps there might have been shoals of them in the far horizon, but lulled into such an opium-like listlessness, a vacant, unconscious reverie, is this absent-minded youth, by blending the cadence of waves with thoughts, that at last he loses his identity, takes the mystic ocean at his feet for the visible image of the deep blue bottomless soul pervading mankind and nature. And every strange, half-seen, gliding, beautiful thing that eludes him, even dimly discovered, uprising fin of some undiscernible form, seems to him the embodiment of those elusive thoughts that only people the soul by continually flitting through it. In this enchanted mood, thy spirit ebbs away to whence it came, becomes diffused through time and space, like Cranmer's sprinkled pantheistic ashes, forming at last a part of every shore the globe round. There is no life in thee now, except that rocking life imparted by a gently rolling ship, by her borrowed from the sea, by the sea from the inscrutable tides of God. But while this sleep, this dream is on ye, move your foot or hand an inch, slip your hold at all, and your identity comes back in horror. Over Descartian vortices you hover, and perhaps at midday, in the fairest weather, with one half-throttle shriek, you drop through that transparent air into the summer sea, no more to rise forever. Heed it well, ye pantheists.